Okay, good morning, everybody. Thanks for making it to the early session. We're going to be speaking now about ways and opportunities that you can hack all around you, all the time. With us this morning is Eleanor Saeta, speaking about playing with the built city. And at the end, we'll have about 10 minutes for questions. And just go to the mic on that side or that side. And Eleanor, if you could please repeat the question for the camera, that'd be great. And with that, I'll give you Eleanor, and please give her a very warm welcome.
Thanks. I'm going to be talking about what you can do to your city and why you might want to do it. How we know what changes are good, how we can evaluate the kinds of changes we might like to make to our cities, why we may want to intervene in our cities, what the other forces that are shaping our cities in ways that we may not like are, how to intervene, and I'll conclude with a bunch of examples of other ways that people have, or some theoretical examples of change in the city. So we're an urban species. As of the end of 2008, half of all people lived in cities. That number is supposed to hit 75% by 2050, possibly higher. Cities are huge conglomerations of wealth. They can't be anything else. They're power systems. They reproduce the socioeconomic hierarchies that create that wealth. Life in the city changes us. Cities define what you can do. They feed back into our actions every single day. They shape our desires. So we might not want that happening to us without any consent, without our say. So maybe we want to change our cities back. Maybe we don't like the way that our cities change us. We can find a lot of good things in cities. We find community, we find culture, we find friends, we find resources. But we also find this kind of totalizing schema of consumption and social alienation and hypernormativity and disengagement. And maybe that's not the city that we want to live in. So urbanism is political. It's necessarily political. The left and the right view those kinds of power structures very differently, and they react to them differently. So I'm not going to try to make this apolitical. We want to cause change so that our cities are more alive, so that they're more human, so that they're more enjoyable. This isn't the kind of criteria that a lot of cities are planned around. It's not that sort of efficiency-based, very capitalist criteria. But we want cities which live, which people can actually enjoy. We're acting necessarily outside control of the state, outside capital, which, again, makes this a political statement. But it's also the way that we as individuals can act on cities. So first I'm going to cover a few ways that you can understand the city. These are ways to think about the kind of change that you want in the city and evaluate those changes. The city that we see is different from the city that other people see. This is true for everyone. In Seattle, I live in an apartment, I go to a cafe, I have an office. These are all different than the fractions of the city that other people see. One person walks down the street by the cafe, another person walks down the street by the grocery store. Even though they're walking down the same objective physical street, they have different mental maps and mental understandings of the city. That understanding is very powerful. The concept of the city as you understand it is called an imaginary. It's both a very concrete way that we navigate space, but also a cultural artifact. It has to do with how we imagine the city, how we understand the city, the emotional affect that spaces have on us. It's produced via cultural processes. We talk about our experiences in the city. We socialize. The city exists in song and music and movies. All of those things create what the city is. Because we are not interacting directly with the factual city, but rather with this imaginary of the city, if we change that imaginary of the city, we change the city in a very real way, even if we haven't altered the city at any concrete level at all. That gives us a very powerful tool to change how we interact with the city. The notion of affordances comes from industrial design. Objects have properties that determine how you can use them. If you walk up to a door and it has a plate on it, you push on the plate to open the door. The concept of an affordance mismatch comes in when you push on the plate and the door doesn't open because you're actually supposed to pull on it. Or alternately, say there's a glass door, but you'd like to close it for privacy, but you know, and that's something that you normally do with doors, but this door doesn't actually support that. We can bring that concept of an affordance into urban design and look at affordances for life, the way the city affords us doing the things that we'd like to do in it. One good example is a bench at a bus stop. You might like to hang out on the bench and talk to friends and, you know, have a sandwich or something, but that bench is designed so that you can only sit on it. You have to kind of sit on the edge and keep it flipped down because they don't want people spending time there. You can make the bench more comfortable to sit on or use less materials, and that's still kind of in the urban design range, or in the industrial design range. As we get into urban design, we start looking at the context for that bench, and then we realize that, oh yeah, people do actually want to sit on this bench for a while, and maybe they get used as ad hoc bike racks, so we'd like to set it up so you can lock a bike to it without interfering with people who'd like to sit on the bench. Or we'd like to turn the bench so that instead of being directly facing into the traffic, so that it's only really useful as space to wait for the bus, you can look down the street, you know, you're more engaged with the life of the sidewalk, you can actually use that as social space all of a sudden. So it's a very small change that can make that bench, can make that into a useful living environment. The liveness of space is a somewhat more obscure concept. It's originally due to Christopher Alexander. It's how well a space supports life in a way that is subjective but cross-culturally repeatable. If you put different people in different spaces, they will all have approximately the same idea of how human and how alive that space is. If you take two city squares as an example, one square is just flat asphalt. There's, you know, no feature, nothing. You know, surrounded by buildings. There's kind of exits at each corner, but it's very precisely square and uniform and empty. That's a pretty dead space. If you take that same exact volume, and maybe the building fronts are a bit skewed, the whole thing isn't perfectly square, you know, it's cobblestones around the edges, there's a bit of a path, there's something in the center. All of a sudden, with very little actual change to the space, it becomes much more human and much more alive. If you put a set of tables and chairs in each square on a nice summer day, the square that is more alive will have more people in it because it's a space that people actually want to spend time in. A strong, positive kind of mental association with a space can help a space out, but in the end, if it's a dismal alleyway, no matter how storied of a dismal alleyway, people aren't going to want to spend time there. So you need to work on both the level of liveness or humanity and on the level of the imaginary. I'm going to move on to the kinds of forces that shape our cities. We have an idea, we have a way of evaluating actions now, but we need the context for our actions. We need to understand why cities take the forms they do. We're going to look first at the kind of macro-scale economic pressures that operate on cities, and then look a bit more at their concrete ramifications. Understanding these forces in their historical concept helps us get that kind of context that we need for actually working in cities. You can think of a city as being pretty directly defined by the economic activity that it supports. It supports that activity generates the city. People congregate there for a lot of reasons, but in order to live, they have to engage in that kind of activity. And that activity changes the shape of the city. In a Western capitalist, late capitalist society, that activity shapes the city more strongly than almost anything else. Capitalism forces all spaces to be valued. If you want to start a business, it has to justify itself by earning money. If you want to start a park, you know, if you want to create a park, it gets forced into that same valuation schema. It's kind of unavoidable. If you're trying to do something which isn't directly profit-driven, you're automatically marginalized by that system, both you and the space, and you're going to be fighting for resources in a way that a profit-generating enterprise doesn't. The concept of highest and best use is related to the idea that any given physical space, any given piece of land, has some use that will generate the most revenue, both for some enterprise and for the city. And there's a lot of pressure in cities to move land towards that highest and best use, which is often directly opposed to quality of life. A lot of the things that we conceive of as generating quality of life, whether it's, you know, parks or museums, useful public transportation, social services, cultural programs, from a capitalist mindset, they're either an overly expensive drain on resources, or they're things which could be better provided by private enterprise, and should be because they could be, you know, basically that because some private enterprise could make money doing that, they should be allowed to. The timescale that capital operates on has an interesting effect on all this too. Enterprises run on quarterly results. You know, if they're lucky and they're far thinking, maybe they're looking to maximize profit in a 5-year window. Whereas the kinds of things which generate quality of life come into being slowly, they're created slowly, they take time. Enterprises are generally quite willing to work against those things for short-term profit, even if they're things like, say, worker education that will create more profit in the long term. Because they're driven by short-term profit, they can't work in that mindset very easily. So if a municipality does want to create those kinds of things, they're forced to do so without any corporate support, as opposed to things like tax incentives, which they get direct corporate support for and corporate lobbying for. The idea of coercive efficiency is a notion which has come into being with globalization. When you have, you know, a dozen cities around the world, 100 cities around the world that are competing against each other, if one city decides, oh, well, we don't actually need parks, so we're not going to spend money on them, that creates pressure on everyone else to get rid of theirs too, because they have to try to be as competitive as those other spaces. So there's this kind of universalizing downward pressure on quality of life to, you know, try and steal business from some other city, or to, you know, retain the enterprise that you have. In a historical mindset, some of the things which have caused major change have been cities trying to control the working class and working class dissatisfaction and to provide an outlet for capital. Capitalist societies accumulate capital in the owning class. This capital has to go somewhere eventually. It's expensive. You can't really have it just sort of sitting around. So you need things which can sink very large amounts of capital. One of the things historically that's been done with this is large urban renewal projects. Haussmann in Paris in the 1850s was kind of one of the first really large examples of this, where he, you know, under Napoleon, tore up huge sections of the city that he considered slums, which were basically just the working class neighborhoods of medieval Paris. He routed boulevards through there, which were designed so that you could move troops quickly in the city to suppress rebellions, and it cost a whole lot of money and put a lot of that excess capital to work. So while this is kind of necessary in capitalist cities, it also creates this very large scale urban destruction. This still goes on if you look at like London with the Olympics projects that are going on. I mean, it's smaller scale and they have better PR, but it's the same kind of thing. Zoning laws and suburbanization are another really interesting effect of capital. With the invention of first the streetcar and then the car and specifically the autobus, cities suddenly became suburban and it became possible to have some of the class barriers around locality in the city break down, that all of a sudden it wasn't guaranteed anymore that your nice rich neighborhood was only going to have people of your class in there because other people could afford to drive in there. And as buildings got taller, all of a sudden there was the issue that, well, maybe, you know, somebody's going to put up a 10-story apartment building right next to your house. And, you know, this can lead to kinds of class desegregation which were considered unfavorable. So zoning laws suddenly showed up. They first appeared in Germany in the 1870s. They spread to America by 1910 or 1911 or so, and were pretty much ubiquitous in most of the Western world by the 20s. They acted to enforce that kind of class segregation. They, to some degree, acted to prevent things that were considered public nuisances, like noxious factories being built near residential districts. But there'd been a whole set of nuisance laws that were in existence before zoning that had pretty much dealt with that same kind of issue, but they weren't powerful enough to deal with the class segregation issue. The other thing that drove zoning laws was capital preservation. Developers in these new suburbs were trying to encourage people to put all of their money into single investments, into owning a house. They needed to be able to try and convince people that that investment was going to retain value. So zoning laws became a tool of capital preservation. When the progressive left finally started challenging these laws, other tactics showed up. We ended up with open space preservation laws, which are actually a tactic to prevent more development. In a lot of cases where the kind of class segregational zoning laws have been ruled that are unconstitutional or you know, cannot be upheld for some reason, cities have decided, oh, well, if we can't control the zoning in the way we want, we just won't allow any new development. Homeowners associations are another thing. Specifically in the US, I don't know how prevalent they are in Europe, when they couldn't get enough enforcement out of zoning laws for details like, you know, paint color uniformity and that kind of thing, you had developments starting to be created with homeowners associations that could enforce much more rigorous strictures as part of the sales contract. Selective enforcement of the type that's common among law intended for social segregation is built into zoning law with the concept of variances, where if a project is considered important enough for the city, almost any of the zoning laws can be selectively waived. A lot of cities will create schemes of incentives around, you know, oh, if you build us this kind of public space, we'll let you build a taller building or whatever. So then the developer builds a public space, but they don't actually have any incentive to make that public space livable. They really don't want people using that space. So they'll create these empty plazas in front of high rises that are designed to not be friendly places to stay. Or they'll create an actually nice place and make it appear as private as possible. It may be legally open space, but they really don't want people from the street coming in there, and they enforce that architecturally. Gentrification has been another fallout of capital. After World War II, we saw a lot of flight from the urban cores, both from, you know, deprivation and, you know, both damage and lack of upkeep to the urban core, lack of accommodation for cars. The cars simply don't fit in urban cores very well. So a lot of people moved out to the suburbs. In America, the GI Bill pushed this a lot, as it gave a lot of people who wouldn't have otherwise bought into houses the opportunity to buy in, which left the urban core with basically the people who couldn't move out left in it. In the 50s and 60s, we got what are kind of epithetically termed urban pioneers moving back into these neighborhoods because they found that, yeah, these were actually pretty nice places to live if you didn't need services, if you were willing to deal with a certain kind of informality. And they, you know, bought apartments, rented apartments, started businesses, that kind of thing, and for the most part didn't integrate that much with the people who were already or who were still living there. And eventually those people get priced out of that, you know, newly cool neighborhood. And then, you know, kind of the next wave of capital comes in and pushes the people who, you know, resettled that neighborhood out. And then this cycle continues at the next neighborhood and the next neighborhood. There's an interesting counterexample that happened before the Second World War in Vienna. Vienna was suddenly being forced to compete on the world market, and they had both falling export prices and rising housing costs due to limited supply. So the city actually bought a third of all the real estate inside the city borders and put up apartments, which they then gave out through lotteries, which is something that just, we can't imagine that happening in a modern city. So it's not that you can't fight gentrification, but that it's really difficult. It requires this kind of large-scale common ownership. The speed that the real estate market moves at makes it really difficult to generate that kind of common ownership without state support. Commercialization of public space, the concept of public space came about in Renaissance Europe. You had public, city plazas that became the kind of social hub of the city. Previous to that, when you had like a king who was literally the body of the state, there couldn't be this concept of the public in the same way. It requires this definition, this split between what is public and what is private. When the state is embodied in one person, there can't be just kind of theoretically this understanding that the private is separate from that. So you didn't really get this concept of what the public space was until you started moving out of that feudal economy into something more market-driven. Public space is basically defined by being intellectually contested. If you have space which is restricted and you can't express views there, it's no longer public. Now that said, access to public space has always been restricted along various social categories. Until the 20th century, women did not have access to public space. It is still contested along a lot of different social lines via selective enforcement of social norms. However, in general, at least in theory, the concept of the public space is space where reasonable actions must be allowed. You must be allowed to campaign for political actions. There's a certain expectation of some level of freedom of speech that is part of what defines space as public. Because these public spaces are kind of the life of the city socially, they end up being very desirable retail territory. So you have, retailers kind of surrounding these public spaces. Starting in the 17th century, you had private creation of spaces that were functionally public. And in the 19th century, you had private creation of private spaces that mimicked the appearance and some of the function of public space, but weren't actually legally public. So you couldn't actually speak your mind there. You had the creation of the first shopping malls. As those became more prevalent with suburbanization and with car transport and could be more effectively segregated by distance and became more of a social category, they eventually got merged back into the city, where you now have in urban cores a lot of spaces that are actually, that appear public but are actually private, or this kind of semi-public, semi-private space. You get things like metropolitan improvement districts, which are technically public, but they have private security and a lot of other weird combinations. Fear in architecture is another interesting way that capital has changed the city. One of the big outcomes of modernity as a project has been this kind of overturning of all these traditional societal norms. And this has created a lot of kind of social fears as categories, things that were normally dealt with via these traditional mechanisms, whether or not those, gave rise to any kind of equality. So modernity creates fear, controls are put in place to try and counteract that fear, and you get the cycle of more control and more fear. Commerce has been another big driver of urban control. You want these controlled environments so that you can sell things. You don't want the dirty, noisy, complicated street and people coming and protesting in your store. You want to keep those people away so that you can have this nice, sanitized shopping experience. This is spread to communities. You have gated communities, whether it's a gated apartment building or, literal gated suburbs. You have companies moving out of the city into office parks. Some of this is happening for theoretically economic reasons, but there's also a lot of, this is a space that we can control. We can put a fence around all the buildings on this campus and know that it's just us here. As technology becomes more and more capable, technology is getting used as a site of control. You have security cameras, you have, tracking for cell phones, you know, there's lots and lots and lots of layers there. These technologies get abused just because they exist. You know, it's basically when you create a power structure like that, when you create a capability like that, it's going to get used. And that's not really talked about that much in the wide stream media. So what can we do to all this? You know, this is a pretty grim picture of where the modern city is, but it's not as one-sided as it seems. You know, this kind of control isn't total. And even some governments are starting to come to understand that, yes, this quality of life thing has something to it and put a certain amount of support behind that. It's often pretty narrowly defined and pretty socioeconomically limited. But, you know, there is some support there. Both large and small scale civic involvement is really critical for countering these kinds of pressures. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about what individuals can do directly through direct action. How do we justify our action in the city? There's this concept of the right to the city. Basically, the city exerts force on you via all of these different means. We have a right to object to that. We have a right to self-determination. This is, you know, a fundamental human right. Therefore, we have a right to act in the city. There's a concept of spatial justice, which is basically combining the social justice movement with this understanding of spatiality and geography and, you know, pushing back against this totalizing control in the city. If we're working in the city, we have a responsibility to work inclusively. The right to the city is founded on equality. There are limited resources in any city for intervention. So if we want to work, we need to work with other people. We need to reach across all of these boundaries, whether it's race, sex, gender, ability, nationality, language, whatever it is. You know, a lot of these boundaries aren't comfortable to breach. They aren't easy to breach, but we have this responsibility to do so. You know, from, you know, the right to the city is based on this concept of equality. One of the issues, especially with working with the imaginaries, and this is one of the things that happened with gentrification, is that you end up in a position where the people who are creating the imaginary for a neighborhood or the imaginary for an environment can't imagine other people in that environment. And so those other people end up getting forced out. You know, it's the artists didn't imagine anyone but artists in their neighborhood and, you know, kind of created these structures that forced other people out. Working with other groups is a big part of this kind of inclusivity. There are a lot of urban networks. There are a lot of cultural groups. Reaching out to those kinds of groups through your actions is important. Informality is an interesting issue. Informality subverts control. It lets you act outside of a lot of these structures that have been created. A lot of the time, the state doesn't bother or can't control that last 5 or that last 10%, and it's not worth it to them to do so. And that gives us room to act. We can create these informal things. We can get away with stuff on the margins. And those small changes add up. This is one of the benefits of working with cultural processes is that all of these small actions in this kind of informal edge regime work. A lot of the times this comes with a cost. You know, if you're trying to make a living in an informal economy, it's not really a great place. So, you know, it can be problematic territory to work in, but it's also a really important area. If the state feels actively threatened, they will clamp down on informal actions, but, you know, there still ends up being margin that we can skate through. So interventions. The idea of an intervention is some intentional change in the city that changes the space that it lives in. It can be a performance. It can be some actual physical creation. It can be art. It can be all sorts of things. It can be, you know, reconfiguring people's understanding of space. All of these can be different kinds of interventions. There are limits to what we can do with an intervention. There are deep social issues that we're trying to address here, but those social issues come from larger forces. So we may be able to slowly create mass change, but we can't literally design our way out of, you know, a lot of these problems. It's important to come back to first principles when you're looking at these kinds of things. Something that worked well in one city may not work in your city. There's a lot of historical context here, which is important to deal with. So, you know, we've got these kind of ideas of affordances, of the humanity, of the life of spaces. starting with those concepts is important instead of just saying, oh, this worked great in San Francisco, obviously it will work in Berlin. We can think of space as an event. Any space that you inhabit has a beginning and an end. If you think about the space that you're occupying when you have a picnic in the park, you put down a blanket and that creates this space. You interact with it as though it was an indoor room. When you take that blanket up, that space goes away. You walk through that area and it no longer feels like indoor space to you. So we can create these very thin spaces that are still actually existent in the city. You know, if a blanket can do it, then almost anything can create a space. And so that can be a really powerful intervention tactic. When we're looking at altering imaginaries, it's important to think about this as play, not shock. With modern mass media and postmodern mass media, shock gets ignored. People don't really pay attention to it anymore. But if you can make people think, if you can make people have an emotional, effective experience, that still gets through. So there's this kind of divider between the things that get ignored and the things that still actually reach people. Creating affordances in the city is one of the other kinds of invention that we can do. A lot of times affordances actually want to be invisible, as opposed to a lot of the other sorts of interventions that we're doing. If they get noticed, they get put in a different category. For example, like DIY bike lanes. If you're gonna go out and paint your own bike lane in the city, you don't want that to get noticed, because if it gets noticed, it gets erased or it doesn't get respected. You want it to just blend into the infrastructure of the city. When we're working, we have our choice of materials. The cheapest thing to work with is data. If we can just change what people know about a city, that's really lightweight, that's really easy. If you want to then say, okay, well, we're going to go to some space, we're going to project light into that space, you know, or sound or that kind of thing, that's still very, very lightweight in a literal sense. It can be a lot easier, but it's kind of the next step. Paint, you know, whether whether it's a bike lane or graffiti or decals or whatever, is sort of your next layer. Fabric or deployable structures, things that you can put up very quickly and take down very quickly, are the sort of the next level of weight, the next level of involvement there. And then we get into real buildings, you know, when you're actually building something real that's going to last in the city. That's a very powerful intervention, but it's also a relatively expensive one. So let's look at some examples. Some of these are theoretical, some of these are things which have actually been done. The intent is to give you guys an idea of the range of things that you can do in a city as individuals. The first that we're going to look at are examples based around mapping the city, changing how people navigate the city, changing directly working on people's imaginaries of the city. Urban exploration is an interesting example of this because it's not something that people normally think about as intervening in the city. But when you go, you know, explore steam tunnels or all of these other places, abandoned buildings, you're recreating the city as a place of wonder. You know, as you talk about that, as you tell people about these stories, it's, you know, oh, hey, did you know that there's this place that you can go? That changes how people see the city pretty directly. Exploration doesn't have to be breaking into abandoned buildings. You know, it can be as simple as breaking out of your routines. We all have these very set routes that we fall into in the city. You know, go to a different cafe, go somewhere else, talk to other people. Learn as many of the facets of your city as you can, and, you know, become a bridge between communities. That kind of exploration changes the structure of the city, because it means that all of these other people that you're talking to know people from outside those communities. Various city games and things of that category can fall into this. Geocaching, letterboxing, that kind of thing. The idea of a psychogeographic walk is going for a walk in the city randomly, you know, flip a coin or roll a die each time you get to a corner, and you just kind of walk this random route through the city, and you explore places that you've never seen before, because they're never places that you would think to go otherwise. There are existing communities around urban exploration, which I would advise you to seek out if you're interested in this. Augmented reality is interesting as a form of architecture. The idea of augmented reality is overlaying video onto, overlaying data onto some video or some, you know, like you have, you know, you hold your phone up and you see it as a window and you see something that's not there. You know, it's a bit more expensive than just looking, but it lets you do things like see, you know, you can see buildings that aren't there. Someone wrote an application where if you've got an iPhone and you're walking around Lower Manhattan, you can see the World Trade Center. You know, they, it's just virtually rebuilt, which is actually a pretty powerful statement. You know, you can use this to visualize buildings that aren't there yet. You know, let's say developers put up some nice fancy renderings for some big project that's going in, and you actually locate those in space, and then you get a much better idea that, oh yeah, no, that's actually gonna overshadow all these buildings and really change the feel of this area in the city in a way that was completely not obvious from the drawings that were presented. So this can become a location of community awareness and community gathering. You can have very lightweight applications that are still on this continuum, you know, things that are just mobile apps that don't do video overlays. Fix My Street in the UK is an interesting example of this, where it gives you this really trivial way from a mobile phone to submit to the local municipality, hey, there's a pothole here you need to fix, that kind of thing. So it brings that into space. It kind of generates that sort of community awareness and involvement. You can use AR to tell stories. You know, it's a great storytelling medium. It's kind of problematic in some ways in the city, though, because it is very class divisive. When you use AR, you are restricting yourself to the people who can afford smartphones and data plans, which is not everyone. And when you buy into those goods, you buy into this kind of consumptive mindset that goes along with them. So it can be a very good tool. It can be an iffy tool. You can use things like 2D barcodes and you know, this idea of like functional graffiti, graffiti that links to resources directly as a, you know, a lighter weight way of doing the same kind of thing. We don't know what's in our cities. There are a lot of resources in cities. They're very rich places, but it's hard to find a lot of this stuff. So a map can be a way to change people's understanding of the city. There's the Fallen Fruit Map in LA, and it basically is a map of fruit trees that overgrow public spaces in California. Any fruit tree that's growing over a public space is public property. You can eat the fruit on it. So this is a map of all those spaces, so all of a sudden those are resources, you know, and that people can actually find without having to spend a lot of time hunting. So this is a way of very directly changing how people understand the city, breaking down those barriers of who knows what. Public art can change cities. You know, that's a pretty direct way of operating on the imaginary of the city. You know, a good art piece can stop you in your tracks, especially when it's presented outside of this kind of sanctified museum space or commercial gallery space. You know, getting permission can rob that kind of art of power. Not getting permission also changes the reception and can make it a lot more negative. There's this kind of, you know, balance that you have to walk there. Temporary art pieces can be pretty productive there. You know, if you're doing something very lightweight with light or, you know, chalk or that kind of thing, it can sometimes still have a lot of that effect. You do a lot more work for the same number of impressions, but, you know, maybe you get better impressions. In 1913 in Berlin, there was a really interesting book published called What a Woman Must Know About Berlin, which was an introduction to how to interact with the city as a modern woman, which was a really revolutionary idea at the time. You know, it wasn't, it had resources listed in there, but it was mostly about, you know, literally, this is how you can use the city. You could create the Hacker's Guidebook to cities or a city in the same way. You know, this is how you can interact with this city. This is, you know, these are the ways that you can interact with these spaces. These are the resources that you can look for. You know, this is this way of thinking about the city. This is an explicit introduction to this imaginary of the city. So infrastructure, semi-legal Wi-Fi, information is citizenship. When we access information, we access the life of our city. In a lot of ways, if you can't get online, you can't really live in modern society. And increasingly, if you can't get online when you're out and about, you can't live in the city. But you know, that's expensive to do. So free mobile access is a way of kind of democratizing the spaces in which it's available. I mean, it doesn't deal with having space to use that. It doesn't deal with the availability of hardware, especially if you're just providing Wi-Fi. But it's a first step, and it's a cheap and easy first step. Establishing point-to-point links for nonprofits, letting people get online that, you know, it would be a stretch to, you know, pay for that kind of bill is another thing that you can do, which is this fairly direct act of bringing people into this fold of modern community. Some of these very kind of quiet infrastructures, like, oh, it's just an open wireless, it's just a wireless that people can get access to. Why is that that important? It projects that, hey, there's somebody in the city that actually cares. You know, there's someone that says, oh, hey, you know, someone out there was thinking that, yeah, I could actually benefit from this. So CCTV is a tool of control. You know, it's used by the police. It's used to suppress riots. It's used to track people. It's used to do all sorts of things. Why not build your own? You know, a lot of the time, if there's a demonstration, oh yeah, all that footage just kind of didn't show up somewhere when it would be useful for exonerating someone. What happens if you have your own network that's offloading video offsite, and all of a sudden, you know, when the arrests come, no, we've got video that didn't happen. You know, I mean, maybe it doesn't keep you out of jail. Maybe it does. Kind of, you know, the police know that they're being videotaped by other people who they can't control as easily. Maybe that restrains them a bit. You know, it's a way of democratizing this tool of control. You know, the right to the city is the right to be heard. If you can't be heard because if you try to say something, you get thrown in jail, you don't have the right to the city. Making those kinds of demonstrations safer, even if they have no political effect, encourages people that, yes, you own the city, you are part of this community, you know, your voice may not change anything, but it will at least still be heard. Bike lanes. Bikes are great. Bikes make good cities. Bike lanes aren't perfect. They create this concept that, well, if you're not in the bike lane, you're in the wrong place. But cities still don't always build them, and, you know, sometimes they're the only safe option. So why wait? In a lot of cities, it's just paint on the ground. You can buy line stripers at a hardware store. You can buy reflective paint. You know, get on a nice work vest, go out there, put in a bike lane. You know, it helps to plan ahead of time. It helps to be familiar with other people that have tried to do this in other cities. It may not last that long. You know, you want to match exactly the way bike lanes are installed normally. You want to make sure they're wide enough. You want to make sure all the markings are right, because otherwise, A, they'll get noticed by the city faster, and B, drivers may ignore them. It's like, oh, that, I don't know what that is. That doesn't actually look like a bike lane. I'm just going to treat it like I'm something. You know, so it's worth doing the work to do it right. But if you do it right, hey, great, new bike lane. You know, and you didn't have to wait for some long planning process. Street furniture. So the streets are what determine the degree of life in the city. If you have a dead street, you have a dead city. If you want to encourage life in the city, you need to make your streets more livable. If you put things out on the street so it becomes something other than a space of transit, you make that space much more living. You can work really cheaply here and say, oh, this is going to get trashed, this is going to disappear. You know, that's probably a good idea. Or you can say, oh, well, the city puts benches in some places. If I can find a bench that looks exactly like that and I put it in, they probably won't notice that they didn't put that bench in. You know, at least not for a really long time. You know, or maybe you just take an existing bench and turn it around so all of a sudden it's a lot more useful. You know, put up hammocks in parks and just leave them there. You know, say, oh, you want to go sleep in a park? Here you go, here's a hammock. You know, make these spaces more livable. Gardens are really nice in cities. You know, when you have a city that's just bare dirt patches and concrete walls with nothing on them, it doesn't really feel that human. But again, you know, plant a garden. You know, you've got a bunch of empty little dirt patches by the side of the road, just, you know, shove some bulbs in them or something, and in the spring, hey, you've got flowers, you know, just ignore them. They'll survive. You know, if you use native plants, it'll be fine. You know, if you've got an abandoned lot near you, start a vegetable garden. You know, you might want to ask the owner. They probably won't care as long as, you know, it's going to be, you know, if you're going to keep the vandals out and you're going to, you know, and they can still build on it if they want to, whatever. You know, it doesn't cost them anything. It may take a little bit of work for you to get the soil good. If the owner agrees, you're less likely to have whatever you're growing there trampled halfway through the season. But even if you don't ask, you can still maybe just do it. Got a really ugly building near you? Plant ivy on it. You know, it'll take a while for it to grow, but eventually you'll have a much less ugly building that's covered in ivy. You know, eventually somebody may come out and notice and cut the ivy off, but you can plant it again. It grows like crazy. You know, there's a reason why it's invasive. There's a lot of existing movements around this kind of gardening. You know, go out and reach out to them, especially if it's a big project. The event city. This is a set of examples that are all kind of events that happen in the city that are either creating temporary spaces, but, you know, using that idea of an event to change people's understanding of the city. One of these is thanks to Mike Bernstein in San Francisco. Mass transit's normally purely functional space. You know, it's not somewhere where you go to play. It's not somewhere where you go to enjoy yourself. You don't go to meet friends on the subway. But there's this really kind of interesting theatricality of the mass transit experience where, you know, you get on, you have this beginning, this middle, this end. You know, it lends itself to this sort of play very well. And if you can convince people that the train they take to work every morning is a fun, interesting place, you can convince them of almost anything in the city being fun and interesting. You know, if you can make their commute fun and they actually get involved, this isn't about putting on a spectacle that's just, you know, going to be kind of ignored, again, that idea of spectacle. This is about getting people actually involved, getting people to actually play with you and interact. I think first, about 6 or 8 months ago, Mike, a friend of mine, set up some BART swings, basically on the public transit in SF. You know, you walk into a car right as it gets into the station, you hook some swings on, you walk out the door. And all of a sudden, hey, there's swings in the car. And then the important bit is you have a bunch of people who are actors in that car, and they say, oh, hey, swings, cool, get on, you know, have fun. And then the first person gets off and points at some random stranger and says, you, come try this. And pretty soon you've got a car full of people playing. So if you're putting on this kind of spectacle, it's really important to get that kind of active pull, that kind of active involvement. You know, if you want to hold a tea party in the city, don't just invite your friends. Invite the other random people who are in the car to have tea with you on the subway. You know, if it's just you guys, it doesn't matter. It's not actually changing anything. You can use the public city as a playground. Conceiving of the city as a playground changes how people think about it, you know, very directly. Games let us tell stories in cities. Those stories have meaning, they have power, people remember them over time. It can be a signal evening event. Slim and Audrey there are putting on Journey to the End of the Year this New Year's Eve, which should be a lot of fun. It's gonna be a city game. You can talk to them afterwards if you're interested. It can also be a large ongoing event like SF Zero is, kind of all over the world, I guess. It's this kind of ongoing event that draws in all sorts of people. If you're only putting on these games inside your subculture, again, you're not reaching anyone new. You have to reach out. You have to reach people who wouldn't normally do this kind of thing and get them involved, because they're the ones, if you can change their ideas about the city, that actually changes things. Parking Day is another interesting one. This was started by a group in SF called Rebar a few years ago. You turn parking spaces into parks for a day. You pay the meter, lay down some sod, put in some trees. All of a sudden, hey, you've got a park. You know, and these parks involve people. They get used like real parks. People come in and it's like, oh, yeah, well, I don't really have to be at lunch too soon. I'll just go hang out in the park for 5 minutes on my way to the restaurant or whatever. You know, they draw attention to the fact that a lot of our cities don't have that much open, public, hospitable, non-commercial space in them. And they also provide this really immediate affordance of, hey, there's a park right here. Space for art is really scarce, especially when money is scarce. And when money is scarce, there's a whole lot of commercial space which is laying empty. So why not use those two? It's not good for landlords if their spaces don't ever get used. Even if there isn't a rent-paying tenant in there, having a space open occasionally, aired out, that kind of thing is actually good for them. You know, it has to get returned clean, all of this kind of stuff. There's going to be a certain amount of work there to make sure that the landlord's getting what they need. But even having people see that space and see, oh yeah, this space is here, it's for rent, it's available, helps them. So, you know, it's beneficial to them and it can be beneficial to you because, hey, all of a sudden, you've got a free space to put up art. Maybe it's just in the windows, maybe you have, you know, you do a whole bunch of work and you do like a three-day gallery that you have staffed so people can come in and see stuff, whatever. But it's free and it's space that's outside of the commercial gallery system so that artists who would not normally get exposure can actually get seen. You don't need bricks to create a third space. Third spaces are one of the really important concepts of space in cities. They're the spaces that aren't work or home, where we go to do things, where we go to socialize, where we go to work on projects, whatever. Get some plastic, you know, drop cloth and tape it together and toss in a battery-powered blower and a cargo bike and inflate a room somewhere in a park. You know, toss in some lights and a table or two, and hey, you've got a cafe that exists until somebody complains or until you get bored and go home. You know, you can literally create these spaces out of thin air. Some of these last examples are going to be a lot more heavyweight. They're going to be examples of how these frameworks scale up. There's been a lot said in the hacker scene about hacker spaces. They're great. You can't really accumulate resources in a temporary space. It's hard to build a lasting culture if you don't have a physical space for it. So the spaces matter. Hacker spaces are great, but they're kind of exclusive. So there's, you know, there's some good, there's some bad there. Some of this may be unavoidable. New spaces are great, but they're not the only answer. If you ignore your neighbors, you recreate the kinds of class problems that we have already that, you know, restrict us from the full access to the city. So don't, you know, if you're involved in creating one of these kinds of third spaces, whether it's a hacker space or some other more diverse space, you know, make sure you're inclusive. Do the work you need to do. Squats are a pretty direct subversion of capital control of real estate. I'm not going to talk too much about them because they're kind of out of scope for this. You know, it's not, the difficulty of doing this should not be underestimated. In a lot of legal regimes, they're not really possible for any meaningful length of time. They're almost always impossible without community support, but they're still interesting in this context of the same set of frameworks. The housing that exists in the city determines what kinds of families can live in the city, what kinds of groups can live in the city. If you have a household with three people in a relationship, it's really hard to find an apartment that that relationship fits into. If you have three single mothers who want to live together and raise their kids together, it's really hard to find a space, if they don't have a lot of money, that that fits into. You know, so either groups of houses working together, you know, groups of households working together to create these kinds of spaces as co-ops or co-housing projects. You know, there are some options there, but in general, the variety of housing stock that you have in a city determines pretty directly the variety of households that you have in the city. So working for more variety in housing means working for more variety in the people around you. If you end up involved in an actual real construction project, there are definitely a lot of things that you can do. The kind of human city that we'd like to see doesn't happen all at once. It happens one brick at a time. It happens one city bench at a time, which is why these small interventions matter. If you're involved in a project, push it in the direction of a more human city. You'd be surprised what you can get away with. You know, just push, just try. Maybe it doesn't work, who cares? You know, you tried, you did your part for making the city more human. Do the right thing. Go change your city, you know, right now. You can do it. You know how, you know the things you might want to change. Go do it. If there are any questions, we can take them at either mic. If you could just go up to the mic so we can hear them all.
Sorry, real quick announcement. We have about 6 minutes for questions.
Okay.
Great.
Hi. Thank you for this great reference, or this just your lecture. I found some examples that I can say, hey, you're right. One example for using bicycles as a way to change the city is, for example, Amsterdam. Everyone knows that. It's a city where people like to go. And I think that's just the reason why they do that. But my real question is, in what context are you working about this? And another thing, I think up to now, cities are planned in a way that human living is not very easy possible. And Perhaps if you change the mind of people, on the long run, you will reach to change to how to build cities. But at the moment, if you have ugly buildings, if you have ugly places, if you have places that hinder you in living humanly, do you really change something then? If you use perhaps light or anything else, it stays an unlivable place?
Yes and no. I mean, if you want to change the buildings, if you want to change all of the big stuff in the city, that does take a lot of time. But changing people's understanding of the city is kind of the first step there. You have to do that. You know, understanding comes before action. If everybody understands that, hey, this city is really ugly and we'd like to fix that, then it will stop being ugly because people will act. So you have to change people's minds before you can change anything else. I'm not quite sure what you meant by the context. A lot of my examples are American. A lot of the time I'm thinking about American cities where you don't have very many bike lanes and there aren't separate bike facilities. You know, speaking to the specific example of a bike-friendly city, you know, whatever context you find yourself in. I mean, these are examples. These are intended to be kind of inspiration. You know, use these and go out and say, okay, hey, in my neighborhood, I can do this very specific thing, and then do that thing.
Hi. First, I find this very inspiring, and I'm really excited to do these things in my city. But I feel that some of your examples, is this loud enough? I feel that some of your examples for city betterment are very artistically driven. Anyone could do them, but it is often the artist communities that do. And at least in the cities that I know, which are Chicago and Miami, gentrification is heavily driven. However, not dispurposefully, not on purpose, by the artist communities. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you agree or disagree with that, or wonder if there's a way to avoid that while still doing artistic things.
I think in a lot of ways that's true. I mean, that does tend to be, you know, the people who are going into these neighborhoods. Traditionally, when people have gone into those neighborhoods, they've stayed inside their own communities, inside their own circles. Don't do that. Don't move into a neighborhood with your friends. Move into a neighborhood and become part of that neighborhood. Get to know your neighbors. You know, that's how you change that kind of thing. You know, work towards, you know, community ownership of property, all of those kinds of things. If you're moving into a community as an outsider, you have a responsibility to the community that you're moving into. You know, so live up to that responsibility.
Thank you.
Hi. In my hometown of Portland, Oregon, it's been a really popular thing of them recently. A lot of the local economists have actually turned what you're talking about into a new social class, and it's called the creative class, and it's been really commoditized by the state. And now a lot of what you're talking about is actually controlled by the state, and it's really hard to get any actual subversive direct action done outside of that scope without it being looked down upon by the entire community. And I'm wondering if you have any suggestions on how to combat that when that happens.
I would say to start, do it anyway. I mean, you know, fine, be looked down on. You know, that's fine. If the state wasn't trying to own those actions, you'd still be looked down on for doing it. You'd just be looked down on for different reasons. So that's really not any different. So, you know, go do it anyway. And then talk about why you're doing it outside of state control, and talk about why it's important to do it outside of state control, and why that makes the actions that you're doing more human and more important.
Thank you.
Okay, we have time for one more question, and if there's more questions after that, Eleanor should meet other people outside and go to a breakout room.
One more question?
Hi, Eleanor. I'd like to question a little bit your notion of the right to the city, because I think it's a right that's probably quite different from a political right. As you move into a city, you acquire this right by living there to some extent, and it's a historical thing. So you refer to this in saying, please reflect the neighborhood you're moving in. But I'm just wondering, how do you actually acquire the right? How fast might this happen? Because, well, personally, I relocated between different cities. And sometimes I felt after 5 years that I actually had the right to change the place because there were people there who lived there before and they didn't ask for my intervention. I somehow had to prove myself of being worth being there. So what's your notion on this?
I think to a certain degree that's going to be a very individual cultural process. You know, you need to, you know, you get to know people and you kind of have a sense of saying, oh yeah, I'm part of this community now. You know, and if you're being honest with yourself and you're actually understanding that, oh yeah, this is now my city, I think you'll have a pretty good idea of, oh yeah, I'm part of this community now. This isn't just, I just moved here, I don't know anyone.
One very brief announcement. Eleanor was kind enough to mention the Journey to the End of the Year game that's taking place here in Berlin on Sylvester or New Year's Eve. There are flyers for that all over the Congress Center. If you're interested in playing, just pick up one of those flyers or go to totheendofthenight.com or meet at Alexanderplatz at the TV Tower stairs on the 31st at 1900. That's 7 o'clock for that game. It'll be over before midnight.
Okay, that's all we got. So let's meet outside this room to continue the discussion if you would like to. Thanks.